Depending on which side of the corporate ledger you're on, disruption is either the end of the world as you know it, or the best thing that ever happened to your bank account. But can that same approach that's given birth to countless tech companies, spoiled traditional industries, and made and ruined venture capitalists the world over, be harnessed and turned on the key civic problem of our time?
We're seeing fentanyl mixed with a variety of different drugs, including cocaine, methamphetamine, a variety of different chemicals.
Fentanyl played a role in one quarter of all fatal overdoses in BC last year. The drug is often mixed with heroin and cocaine, unbeknownst to users.
Fentanyl could get on other drugs, either intentionally or even unintentionally.
Farrell say they were aware Zion tried marijuana, but say they don't know how he got hold of what turned out to be a deadly pill.
I feel that what he thought he had was Xanax.
The scope of this problem is immense, and it's obvious. Drug users are ingesting dangerous substances, often without knowing what's in them, and they are dying by the thousands. Traditional approaches have looked for political solutions, for money, for research, or counseling, or for law enforcement. But what if we could step in at the most critical moment and offer a unique service? And what if that service came in the form of a question? Hey, that street drug you're about to take, do you want to know what's in it before you inject it? Can you fight addiction and overdoses with that kind of information, with the right information at precisely the right time? Can we disrupt the opioid crisis? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Dr. Dan Werb is a scientist, technically an addictions epidemiologist, working with the St. Michael's Hospital Center for Urban Health Solutions to find new ways to combat a crisis that's claiming lives daily in Canada. Dan, first of all, since the point of your approach comes from the ground up, explain how the new project works, but also tell us, who is Chris?
Sure. So I run a center out of St. Mike's called the Center on Drug Policy Evaluation, and we do lots of implementation work here in Toronto to try to respond to risks, particularly around injection drug use.
Right.
One of the things that we're doing is implementing a street drug checking network. So what that means is people are going to be able to show up to supervised consumption sites, community health agencies like frontline harm reduction sites, provide a sample of the street drug that they are intending to use and have it analyzed with some really sophisticated instruments at St. Michael's Hospital and at CAMH. We're going to be able to tell people exactly all the components, all the substances that are circulating in the drugs that they're going to use, knowing that there's really toxic substances out there like fentanyl, which are hugely consequential in terms of making people at risk of overdose, providing people with the information that they about the drugs that they're intending to inject can, you know, have a really protective effect.
Right.
So one of the things that we've done, you know, we don't want to just simply go into the community and say, okay, we're imposing this service and it's going to look like this and, you know, live with it.
Right.
What we've done is we've struck a community advisory board of people. And these are people from the community, people who use drugs, people who identify as drug users, to basically tell us how to make the system work the best possible way. And Chris is one of those people on our community advisory board. He's basically an expert in service design in terms of the barriers that people experience when they're trying to, you know, when you're often street entrenched and when you're using drugs and you're trying to access services to mitigate some of the health and social impacts that people feel when they're relying on the street drug supply. So he's, you know, been basically like a massive resource for us in terms of explaining how to design this life-saving service.
And does he then go out and evangelize it for you?
I mean, we're getting close to launch, but okay. Yeah, I mean, I think he would be sort of an early proponent among his, you know, his social network about why this is an important service, how it could be helpful, kind of what to expect, what not to expect, its limitations, and, you know, how basically like how people can incorporate this service into their daily life. But the hope is, you know, that with the help of people like Chris, who are, again, like the experts on what it takes to solve some of the health issues that people who use drugs in the city face because of the policy and criminalization that they experience daily, you know, with his help in explaining that, we can design a better system.
Before you kind of go on to the front lines with that system, have you tried to get a sense of the scope of the problem in Toronto?
Yeah, there is actually some pretty compelling data that's unfortunately, the most compelling data we have comes from the coroner's office. And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And year over year, we're just seeing an increase in the number of people in Toronto who are dying of overdoses and an increase in the proportion of people who are dying specifically of fentanyl-related overdoses. One of the major drivers here is the fact that our street drug market in or the street drug supply in Canada is just poisoned. It's just absolutely poisoned. And the analogy I like to make is this exhibit that we're going to talk about is really focused on stigma. And the analogy I like to make is, you know, how do you think the government will respond if Toronto's water supply was poisoned?
Right.
Like, how rapidly would there be quarantining? How rapidly would we be flooding, you know, the supply with fresh water? How rapidly would our response be in terms of making sure that everybody knew the risks, informing people, educating, analyzing the substances? Now, that's happening in Toronto. It's just that people are dependent on a supply of street drugs rather than water. These are people who rely on one supply, and they are being poisoned. And the fact that we see a difference in the, you know, the slow response of government, well, we have to consider the risks of actually intervening, and there are regulations around this. Mm-hmm. Like, all of that is stigma turned into policy. Slowing down the policy works. Slowing down the speed at which we can intervene and stop people from dying of really, unfortunately, extremely preventable deaths.
When you're trying to take this technology out to the streets and test these drugs, what has stood in your way before now?
So to do this, I mean, we were funded to do this, and you know, we were funded by Health Canada, which is amazing. So they're interested in helping us to respond and provide people with hopefully life-saving information about the kinds of toxic substances that are in the street drugs that people are going to use. But we've had to go through all kinds of, you know, regulatory hurdles. There's exemptions from the Canadian Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. There's four layers of Research Ethics Board approvals that we've had to do. We've had to basically make the case for why including people who use drugs as core members of our team is integral to the success of this project. And it's not just implementation, but we also have to, because we're scientists, we have to evaluate it and make sure that, you know, we're actually seeing the effectiveness that we hope we're going to see.
Right.
But really, you know, again, like, for all the interest that government has in trying to mitigate, you know, this opioid overdose epidemic, at the same time, like, we are just facing administrative hurdles all over the place. We're overcoming them, and that's great. And in a way, you know, we got to crash through these layers of bureaucracy now so that in the future they're kind of trampled a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's a slog for sure.
If the best data we have now comes from the coroner's office, what do we need to do to find better numbers so that we can stop this, at least in some people, and help them before it gets there?
Yeah. So, you know, increasingly people in this field are talking about the idea of a care cascade. So this was an idea that came about originally in HIV. So people talked about an HIV care cascade where you seek out populations at risk of HIV, you test people to see if they've got HIV, you get people into treatment, and then you retain them in treatment. So sort of like a stepwise, sequential, really straightforward way of thinking about, you know, how do we address an epidemic? And in that case of infectious disease.
Yeah.
And increasingly, people are thinking about addiction and, you know, injection drug use and substance use disorders in that same way. So thinking about, you know, overdose as an epidemic. And you hear that in the literature, in the media a lot and in the scientific literature. So thinking about, you know, can we adapt this care cascade model so that we can early on identify people who are at risk of overdose, who are at risk of substance use disorders, who are potentially experiencing substance use disorders, and then early on get them the care that they need, find ways to have people reliant on something other than the street drug supply, because that is going to be the number one way that people reduce their risk of overdose. So it's really about creating like a new framework for intervening. And luckily, we have lessons from the HIV epidemic that we can apply, and the effectiveness in which, in a lot of places, HIV epidemics were eradicated through this cascade of care approach.
Does it change the stigma around opioid abuse or addiction, the fact that a lot of these are prescribed and come from doctors as opposed to street drugs?
Yeah. I mean, straight up, when a bunch of white people or you know, populations that have not been racialized start to experience the kinds of mortality and health harms that historically racialized and stigmatized populations experience, yeah, suddenly there's a lot more interest in it. That's just an unfortunate fact. What that provides is a policy space that we didn't have before to try to make fundamental changes to the way that society understands drug use, the way that they understand substance use disorders, problematic substance use, addiction. And hopefully, you know, rather than just ignore these questions when they recede from the view, I my hope is that we can really make some fundamental changes in policy and practice that can prevent future epidemics related to drug use.
We tend to talk a ton in the media, and we've done it on this podcast too, about the opioid crisis, the fentanyl crisis, et cetera. But you've called it the opioid overdose epidemic. What do these terms mean, and why do they seem so interchangeable?
Yeah, you know, I see it both in the scientific literature and in the media, where people talk about, you know, on the one hand, opioid crisis, opioid epidemic, overdose epidemic, overdose crisis. And while they might seem interchangeable, they're actually, I mean, they're related but distinct terms. So on the one hand, I like to think, well, do we have an opioid use epidemic? And in part, we do. And that's related to overprescribing, as you mentioned, and the fact that there's a larger population that is now using opioids. But we've also got a pretty stable population that is at highest risk of overdose. And that's people who are relying on the street drug supply. And what you see is, with a larger population of people who have been prescribed opioids, if their access to opioids, then prescription opioids, then becomes restricted, often people will move into the street drug supply. And then it's the people that are relying on the street drug supply that come into contact with these super high potency toxic adulterants like fentanyl. And that's where the highest risk of overdose lies. So in terms of people's thinking about it, and it's important to disentangle those two, like the use on the one hand, the use of prescription opioids, the non-medical use of prescription opioids, and then the overdose, like opioid overdose risk on the other, because while they're related, trying to figure out an approach that can prevent the greatest harms around overdose really requires us to understand how, you know, the ways in which they're related and the ways in which they're distinct.
When you in this project take to the streets and offer to test drugs for people, how do you convince them to participate? Do you see barriers to that? Are they reticent?
No, I mean, I think people have been talking about street drug checking in particular for a long time.
How often does it happen, though? Does it happen in any other major city in Canada?
Street drug checking? So we are collaborating with a group in Vancouver. So they started their street drug checking approach when we did. Okay. So that's basically the only other place in Canada. People have been calling for this for a long time, and people who are relying on the street drug supply are more, they understand better than anyone why this is required. Again, it's like if you have to drink water every day and you don't know whether the glass of water you're about to drink is going to kill you or not, you know, you will be pretty aware of the need to test that substance.
How does it work on a practical level? Someone would come to your clinic.
So people present at supervised consumption sites,
right?
And they provide a really small sample of their of the substance that they're intending to use. That is then run to a hospital lab, either at St. Michael's Hospital or at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. The sample is analyzed using a mass spectrometry instrument, which is like $1 million, extremely sophisticated analytic tool. Or technology. And then that information is then going to be provided back to the original client through someone who works at the frontline agency. And the reason for that is, you know, we want to make sure that people are provided not only with the information about what's in their substance, but also strategies to, now that they have that information, now that they know what their, you know, what the drug is that they were intending to use, how to prevent or how to reduce their risk of overdose.
But you don't take the drug even if it's extremely dangerous.
That is up to the person. I mean, we're not in the business of confiscating drugs.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen, I think there's a long history of law enforcement approaches and criminalization that has basically tried to take drugs from people and only made the situation much more dangerous. You know, this goes hand in hand with increasing access to medication-assisted treatment.
Right.
So street drug checking, like providing someone with information about what's in their drug without any other services is not going to make a huge change. Mm-hmm. But if you provide someone with information about the drug that they might be using, and you also provide them with a safe place to inject, like a supervised consumption site where there is naloxone available, where there is medical staff ready to revive people if they overdose, now you're getting somewhere. Now, one really interesting aspect of this that we've been developing is around seeing how these kinds of harm reduction approaches and biomedical treatment approaches can not only help to reduce the risks that people who use and inject drugs now experience, but might actually help to reduce future cases of injection drug use.
By integrating them into care systems.
Well, yeah. So what we found, I'm running a seven-city study that's funded through the U.S. National Institute on Drug Abuse looking at what makes people more or less likely to initiate injection drug use. And what we found is that people who are interested in starting to inject drugs often ask people who are already injecting to help them in that initial injection drug use experience. And for people who are already injecting, it's a really difficult situation because if somebody asks you and you say no, but they're really highly motivated, you know that they might go to someone who is maybe more dangerous. If you say yes, then you know that you're basically, you know, in some way, people feel like they're responsible for the health of that person after they start injecting. So what we've heard from people is that they really want to avoid these situations in which they're asked to initiate or help facilitate the entry of other people into injecting. We've looked at a whole range of factors that might make people more or less likely to be in these situations in which they're asked to help others. And the one protective factor that we found is being enrolled in medication-assisted treatment. So put another way, if you're someone who injects drugs and you're enrolled in like methadone or Suboxone or hydromorphone, your risk of being asked to initiate others and initiating others into injection is basically halved.
Because there are other resources.
Because people are able to manage their own drug use.
Right.
People are not necessarily going to be interacting and engaging with people who are at risk of starting to inject drugs. And people's use of drugs is sort of stabilized and more predictable. So then what you've got is a situation where if you provide individuals with the kinds of resources that they need, get them into treatment, and again, getting back to this cascade of care model, right? Mm-hmm. You get people into treatment, you retain people in treatment, you provide them with the services that they need. You might actually see a reduction in future cases of people starting to inject.
The first thing that I heard about the work that you and your team are doing was headlined Disrupting the Opioid Crisis. And we talk about disruption when we talk business and we talk about new apps and Silicon Valley and stuff.
Yeah.
How does that disruption model apply to what you're doing?
Yeah, so I think exactly what I've just described, you know, this is an approach that is totally new. The idea that if we can provide people with treatment now, if we can provide people who inject drugs with treatment now and the kinds of services that they need, right? So this is where you need like these wraparound services like supervised consumption, street drug checking, access to housing and treatment, like all these things that help stabilize someone's life. Providing that can actually have an upstream preventive impact on future cases of injection drug use because we know that people who inject drugs are placed in situations where they're asked to initiate others, and they might do so because they're, you know, in withdrawal. They've been asked to, you know, they've been offered to share drugs with this person, or this person maybe offers money. But if you're in a situation where you can bolster yourself against helping someone else initiate their own injection drug use, you actually see a huge number of potential cases averted where instead of starting to inject drugs, people, you know, are effectively, you know, maintain their non-injection drug use and or maybe even enroll in treatment themselves.
It sounds a lot like vaccinations and you're kind of seeking herd immunity.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually directly, again, you know, we talked about the HIV care cascade, and it's this idea was really born out of the idea of HIV treatment as prevention, where HIV treatment as prevention, which is this, which, you know, really disrupted the approach to HIV infection, where people understood that, you know, HIV treatment is so effective now that if someone is on treatment and basically the level of virus in their blood goes to undetectable levels, mm-hmm. that's great for the individual, right? But if their virus is at undetectable levels, they're effectively incapable of transmitting that virus to someone else. So you've got a full integration of efforts to treat people with efforts to prevent, you know, the expansion of HIV epidemics at the population level. Similarly, you know, thinking about, well, if we can address the needs of people who inject drugs now, if we can understand what makes people more likely to not only enroll in treatment but stay in treatment, we might actually see this larger preventive impact at the population level, because we know that people who inject drugs who are enrolled in treatment are much less likely to be in situations in which they're asked to facilitate other people's entry into injecting.
How will you measure the success of this program, and how long will it take?
Those are always the hardest questions for scientists. So we've got, you know, a pretty interesting infrastructure for research. We have a linkage between, currently linkages between seven cohort studies of people who inject drugs in Vancouver, in San Diego, California, in Tijuana, Mexico, across the border from San Diego, and in four sites in France: Bordeaux, Marseille, Strasbourg, and Paris. To that, we are adding Toronto. We have developed a cohort study of people who inject drugs in Toronto, and we're following people's journey through accessing the range of services that people have here. So street drug check-in, access to treatment, supervised consumption sites. And what we're going to do is basically understand, you know, we're going to look at all these different sites, which all have a different mix of services and where people are presented with different risks, and see internationally, basically, how access to certain services both addresses people's risk of overdose and also addresses their risk of being asked to initiate other people into injecting. And we can basically understand what's happening for people in Toronto while also comparing across all these different sites internationally.
I hope we get to talk again when we can see some results.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.
Dr. Dan Werb of St. Michael's Hospital and the Center for Urban Health Solutions. That was The Big Story. For more from us, visit us at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or at thebigstorypodcast.ca, or come talk to us on social media at TheBigStoryFPN on Twitter or at FrequencyPods. And of course, everywhere you get podcasts, that's where we are. You can like us, rate us, review us. The most important thing to do is subscribe. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rowlings. We'll talk tomorrow.